and for Lars, who is not here. I have my notes from last semester, which he wanted to have a look at, but since he's not here, it doesn't help that anyone sees Lars. I have my notes with me, but I will probably take them home tonight, so he has to catch me in the available interval. We talked about fully nonlinear, a local theory for fully nonlinear. We're going to talk about a local theory for fully nonlinear scalar equations. And this is a classical theory dating for surely more than a century and a half. So our equations, as I first stated, are going to be functions of x, u, and partial x, u, equals 0. Simply that, where u is a scalar, x is a vector, x is a position vector, u is a scalar, and then, of course, then this is n components, one component, and n components. And we started out by quasi-linear theory. That is, in the special case where the equation is linear in the top in the first partial derivatives of x, we have the system looks as follows. A can depend on x and u, partial x, u, and a is a vector and x is a vector because of this situation, equals or minus c of x, u is what we called it, equals 0. And I described a geometric theory of that. And I'm going to try to speed up because we have many things to talk about. So let me say that we in describing this, I left it to you to do the n-dimensional theory. Really, I just did two n equals 2 case, which was descriptive, and we could write, we could draw pictures. So we did the case n equals 2. What I want to do is carry on this. So what I want to talk about today is my section 3.3, it's shock formation. And it's our first steps of getting into a global theory, or more global theory of solutions. So what I wanted to do was, again, I'm going to talk about x, y in R2. I'm going to do the n equals 2 case. And I'm going to talk about quasi-linear theory. In fact, I'm going to simplify this a little bit and talk about a subset of the problem. So we're going to consider at least first off, we're going to consider simply Berger's equation, which is an example of a quasi-linear equation in two variables. So that is equation one of the day, which I want to do as follows. There's an x and a y in R2. So partial yu plus u partial xu equals 0. So let me see. In case n equals 2, I guess we denoted this a of x and y and u partial xu plus b of x and y and u partial yu minus c, which also depends on x, and y and u equals 0. And so this has b equals 1, a equals u itself, and c equals 0. That's the case. And now with what a teacher of mine used to say, with malice of foresight, I want to simply set y equals t, because physically, I want to think of this as an evolution equation. And I should ask, this is a common equation that many people have seen before. So who has seen this before? Right. 3/4 of the people. But let's do it anyway, okay? And what I want to do in today and tomorrow is general nonlinear theory, but I also want to see how far I can get on the global existence theory, including shocks for Berger's equation. Okay, so I'm going to simply set y equals t. That allows me to erase this and put in a t, and I want to study this equation. And we think of it as a time evolution of something, t being time. Now, it's one of a class, so it's an example of a conservation law. So a conservation law specifies two things. So I want to now derive conservation laws, and we'll come back to Berger's equation as an example, prime example of a conservation law. So we think of U of X, T, as a density. So, quote, a density. So a density of some stuff. For example, in gas dynamics, it would be the density of the gas at that point, X and T. And then we think of another auxiliary function, F, as a flux. And it's F of U, so it's a flux given the density U at a point. And then conservation law. So I want to come back. I want to derive one from some principle. Not exactly a first principle, because I'm a mathematician. I'm allowed to define the terms, but I want to derive it in some sense from a principle, which I think is a good principle to have. So the fact that it's a conservation law dictates a principle. So a conservation law says that over any interval, and now remember I stuck n equals 2, so I'm looking at a conservation law in one x and one t variable, and there's an analogous thing when I have n variables. But it's easiest to state in one variable. So over any interval, a, b, in that one variable in x, we have the following rule, that the amount of that stuff, or amount of matter, at that time t, in that interval a, b, can change. But its change is due to the following things. The flux due to u exiting from the point b, minus the flux entering point A, that is balanced. Now everyone can relay that message to Laura's, which is I brought my notes from last term, in case you want to look at them still. So this is to say, now let's do a big if. If F If f of u of x is differentiable, then we can do something with that last f of b minus f of a. I can rewrite this as the time derivative of from a to b, u of x t, dx, plus f of b minus f of a is the integral from a to b of d by dx of f of u dx, and that remains zero. And if I f is differentiable, and I'm also going to say u itself is differentiable, continuously differentiable, let's say. So let me do it this way, over x and a, b, and t and 0, say capital T. Then let me put the time derivative through and integrate the whole thing. And then it says, then over any subinterval, we're going to have the following thing. We're going to have the integral from A prime to B prime. So it's any subinterval of d by dt u of x, so d by dt u of x of t, plus partial x of f of u of x of t dx, And that has to, of course, because I can choose any interval and have this hold, I can choose any subinterval and have this hold, and that is zero, which is to say that I've solved equation three. If u is c1, I've solved equation three, that is, dtu plus partial x, the quantity f of u, equals zero. And I can also, I've just had this impulse to work, to use the chain rule, just as long as f is a differentiable function. So it's also saying d by dtu plus x, this is f sub u, right? So partial u f, which is a function of u of x and t, times partial x u equals zero. And furthermore, I want to say that this I am going to often call a function c of u. So this is, by definition, c of u. It's like a velocity. It's a characteristic velocity. And now back to Berger's equation. So I worked myself into a corner here, but Berger's equation, the flux, depending on u, is 1/2 u squared. So then, if we just do this calculation, partial uf is, of course, u, and we just check that's the c of u in the equation 1. So this is now corresponds well to equation 1. So that's what I wanted to do. So it's a general form of a conservation law. Scalar case, a vector case is similar, but I'm going to talk about solving scalar cases. So we should use our first order theory method. So we should use our first order methods. Which is the method of characteristics. Method of characteristics. So let's see how we do that. Well, then we're going to have, remembering the characteristic equations for the quasi-linear case, we're supposed to solve dx by dt is equal to a, which depends on x and y and z. And so that, and for Berger's equation, that's going to be dx by dt is equal to z, because the coefficient, because I'm considering y is equal to t, so x is equal to the second variable. So that whose coefficient is u, so that's z. Dy by dt is supposed to be b of x, y, z. So that reads for us dy by dt equals 1, which exhibits the malice aforesight, meaning that I wanted to call it t, and if I go back to my notation that it should be x and y, like our previous little small theory, that says y is equal to t, maybe plus a constant. And then dz by dt, these are the characteristic equations, is supposed to be c of x, y, and z. And of course, that over here says dz by dt is equal to 0. So along the characteristic, z doesn't change its value. Y we call t, and x translates with speed z. And so we can solve this. Solution of this, of these ODEs, it says the following, that let's do z first. Z, and remember, we're going to solve it in s and t, because we're solving a parameterized family of, I should have given initial data. So let's solve this with the initial value problem. Remember, we're allowed to give a Cauchy curve and data on that Cauchy curve. In higher dimensions, it would be a Cauchy surface and data on that. But here, we want to do the initial value problem. So I'm going to set that x is equal to s, y is equal to 0, or t is equal to 0. And now I want z to be equal to my data, which will say h of s. And that specifies the value of u at initial time as x varies, x being parameterized by s initially. Okay, and now I want to solve these equations. So the second equation is easy. That says y, every time you see a y, I should have put in a t, and I've been doing that in any case. The x equation is going to be, the z equation, dz by dt is 0, so that says, I'm writing this a little wrong, so let me try to be consistent with my notation. That says I want x, I'm going to parameterize the surface by s and t. So the x, and I need a surface in three dimensions, x, y, z space, a function of s and t. So x of s and 0 is equal to s, y of s and 0 is equal to 0, and z of s and 0 I want to be h of s. That's what initial data is, and then I want to solve. That's what I want to do. And so, of course, it tells us that y of s and t is, of course, just t. So we knew that all along. I've been adapting for that. So let's not even write it down. How about x? How about z first? So z of s and t, we solve this, so it has to be equal to z of s and 0, because it's independent of t, so that's h of s. And now let's solve for x, which says dx by dt is equal to z. So that says x of s and t is equal to x at 0, right? So x dot is equal to z, but z is a constant. So x of s of t is x 0, which is s, plus t times the value of z of s is 0. So it's s plus t times h of s, as everyone knows. And those are, of course, is a solution. It's just write it down. It's defined for all s and t. And we can write a picture. Picture of the solution. So let's try this out. I want to do a series of pictures because I have fun drawing. Here's x of t, and then below it, I want to do I'm going to somehow write three-dimensional space looking a bit like this. So there's x and t, and then below it, I'm going to say the same x, but instead of projecting on the xt space, I'm going to project on the xz space. So I'm going to give initial data looking a little bit like this. How about if it's up here, and then it's down here? And then what I'm going to do is on this picture, I guess I needn't make it such a large t-axis. What I want to do is draw the initial characteristic vector field given this data. So this says that dz by dt is equal to 0 says that I guess I'm going to do it in xt space, so I'm not even going to consider how that dz by dt component of the vector field is, but it's horizontal in any case. It doesn't point out of the board. That's the third line. The second line is the t component, that's what I'm supposed to ignore. And the first one is dx by dt is equal to z. So that says when z is high, the vector field looks like this. And it's a constant vector field over there, and then it diminishes. And I deliberately did a vector field which is kind of focusing. And then over here, the x component is negative. But it goes to a negative constant. There we are. And that's a picture, at least, of the solution in the first instant of time. So let's cut at some T1, say, and I want to now draw the solution. And if I have colored chalk, I can do that, which is z is constant on this, but the level of z, the height of z here is now the height of z here. So that says that this is steepening up because the height is moving in. So now the new solution looks a bit like this. Right? That's what happens on the t equals zero, at that time, t1, say. And now, of course, I have to, out of this solution, I have to recover a function u of x and t. So let me do that. Let's check. In fact, we should have checked already. We just solved it, but we should have checked whether the initial curve is characteristic or not. So check the whether the initial Cauchy curve, S0H of S, is characteristic, which is to say we have to check the determinant of, well, let's see, we have x as a function of s and t, and y as a function of s and t. So I have to look at x of s, y sub s, x t, y sub t, and then I have to do this at t equals 0. So all I have to do is consider these equations and then the two characteristic components. So that's the same as the determinant. X sub s is 1, y sub s is 0, x sub t is z, and y sub t is 1, because y is equal to t, so it's always equal to 1. So it's never 0 on the Cauchy, on the initial curve, and we already checked that before. But then at later times, let's see what we have to do. At later times, to recover a graph of a function as a solution of the equation, we want to be able to, S and T are artificial. We want to invert the relationship for X and Y, so to speak. And so I have to see whether I can invert that transformation. So at later times, can we invert ST mapping to X, Y, ? Because we want to find U of X and Y, so to speak, as what we want to recover U of X, so to recover this function. And let's just check. So at later times, we look at the determinant of XS, YS, XT, YT, but this is not at T equals 0. This is at some later time. T is equal to capital T. And of course, that's the determinant of, now let's look up all these quantities. X sub S is now S plus T Z. So that's going to be, so X is S plus T Z. So X sub S is 1 plus T, Z of S0 is H of S, so partial S, H. And Y sub S, of course, Y doesn't change, so that's always 0. X sub T is just Z, which is just H, H of S. And Y sub T is always 1. So that determinant is equal to 1 plus T, DS, H, S. And the question is, is this non-zero? So the statement is, not necessarily. And it is non-zero, except there's going to be a point where there are definitely potential points where it vanishes. So this is non-zero for a bit of time. Well, I drew it over here. By the time t1, it's still, you can solve x, y in terms of s and t, but at later times, not necessarily. So however, however, when t is such that 1 plus t partial s h of s equals 0, no longer invertible. And now since we are taking t greater than 0, that happens when the s derivative of h is negative, and the first time it will happen is the most negative point. So it first happens at, say, let's say t2, the point associated with basically the minimum, maybe I should say the nth, minimum, nth, I guess, nth of h, nth over s in the reals of h of s. And if this is negative, then that will occur, and we have a time t2 at which you can no longer invert. And in fact, let's just draw that time. There's a time, say, t2 here. And if I follow these curves, these are dictating my solution is supposed to be, I'll put a new one in here because I want it to actually focus at t2. Whoops. Not perfect drawing. Let me adjust things a little bit. There we go. These are curves along which the solution is constant. And as soon as you get to this region, you are finding that there are, if you try to ascribe the value of z at this point, there are three possibilities as being covered. And this is the first time in which that occurs. And people say a shock has formed. Well, at least something has formed. And if I draw the picture at time t2 of the graph, it basically looks like something like this. Exactly at t2, it's, how do I do it? It's almost infinite in slope and just infinite slope right there. And then at later time, so at time t3, the picture is getting a little messy, so I'm going to put t3 quite a bit above. And then this overlap region has spread. And so it's pretty easy to see what that does is that, here I'll try to draw it in yellow, that my solution in ST carries on. It doesn't matter. It just carries on. But it becomes multiple valued when you try to solve for x and y in terms of s and t, and that solution looks like that. So let me just label this as this is what happens at t3, this is what happens at t2, this is what happens at t1, and this happens when t is equal to, that's the data when t is equal to 0. Blow up occurring at the steepest part. First blow up occurring at the steepest part. That's our analysis right here. So it leads us to state a small theorem. And if we're keeping track of the numbers right, this is theorem 3.5, which says if the initial data is decreasing somewhere, so if h of s is decreasing somewhere, then the solution will become singular at some time t greater than 0. And of course the proof is, as we've done the proof, is simply our Jacobian determinant. The determinant of xs, ys, xt, yt is exactly this, 1 plus t partial sh, and it becomes 0. And just looking at that in the picture tells us that the solution is no longer single-valued in terms of x and t. And that also dictates, what is t1, t2? Should have called it something special, T star, the time of singularity, is, of course, is equal to, solve for this, minus 1 over partial S H of S0, where S0 achieves the minimum, the negative minimum of H of S. Well, it's all straightforward. All we did was compute a Jacobian. Explicitly solve an ODE and compute a Jacobian. Second proof of the theorem. Proof number two. So proof number two of this theorem. Let's see. Let's just go back to this definition. And I want to make an implicit form, I want to make an implicit expression of the solution. So, implicit expression of the solution. So let's see how I want to do this. I mean, it's U is equal to Z of S and T at that point, S and T, in those parameters, which of course is equal to H of S, because Z does not change along T coordinates. And of course, Y is equal to T, the way we've done things. And then X is equal to S plus Z of S0 T. So we could write, so let me rewrite number one. So rewrite U is equal to H of S. But what is S? It's X minus Z of T. So it's X minus, and Z is, of course, Z is, of course, U, T. That's what I want to write. It's a true statement, although U refers, in my definition for U, it refers to U, but it's still a true statement. And now I want to, and of course, U is a function of X and T, at least before the blow-up time, and I want to just differentiate with respect to X. So that says dxu is equal to, I have to use the chain rule, so partial sh at that point in question times derivative with respect to this. So that's 1 minus dxu times t. And then solve for dxu. And that says, of course, is equal to h prime, h, so dsh, I'll just say, dsh over 1 plus t times dsh. And t is going positive. This is a t. T, I'm moving to the future. So any point S at which dsh, S naught at which dsh of S naught is negative leads to a singularity. That's just that. And you take the minimum point and you find, I mean, this varies with S as you move S around. The first time you get it is S naught. Is this int that I talked about. The first time you get it is this S naught. Right? So that's the second proof and the end of the second proof. Well, that's all simple. But it's a little saddening or wisening or something. It says that you have to admit solutions. I started with C1 solutions or even C infinity solutions, but immediately, well, not immediately, but in fixed a small amount of time, certain amount of time, we are no longer in that class of solutions. So the sad thing is it forces us to admit, to enlarge our class of solutions. So we have to admit solutions with jumps, or else, because this one developed a jump, or it developed multiple values. And so to resolve that we want a function u of x and t, we're going to have to have our solution jump sometimes. So it's sad because we have to employ jumps in the solution, and we're supposed to have differentiable solutions. It's It's what can I say? It's an object lesson. So now that we're forced to admit solutions with jumps, we have to go back to the PDE and ask, how should it behave at a jump? And it's not, and you cannot read that off from equation one. It's not part of equation one, but it is part of the statement of a conservation law. Because the conservation law says that this holds too. And then if F is smooth in U and then U is C1, then we can do a calculation saying that that equation has to hold or this equation has to hold. But suppose it's not C1. Suppose it jumps. Let's go back to this formula. So, definition 3.6. The function U of XT is, and it's going to be a definition of a weak solution. How can I say it? There are zillions of definitions of weak solutions. This is adapted for this setting, and it's a very reasonable one. I'd say this is the model, at least one of the model weak solutions. This is a weak solution. So I'm defining a weak solution of Berger's equation. That's our equation one. If it always satisfies the original conservation law. Which is this thing, d by dt of integral from a to b of u dx. Right? This is for all choices of intervals, all a, b intervals. We have to do this. This change can only be accommodated by having f of u of b minus f of u of a. And that's for all choices of a and b. And I should say it, weak solution of one, that's Berger's equation. Maybe I should say it's a weak solution of three. That says any old conservation law. And Berger's equation in particular. We've just been playing with Berger's equation. But the other equations admit the same fault. We need more solutions than just C1 or continuous ones. Despite the fact we're busy taking derivatives because it's a partial differential equation. Okay? We'll address that in a second, but I'm just saying this is an equation which I've derived from a principle of conservation. So that means that stems from U is a density, F is a flux, and F depends on U in a local way. Okay? So, where are we? We just wrote these down again so I can erase. Tell you, I can feel my shoveling muscles. Okay, so let's make some remarks about this. At points xt where U is C1, so U being C1 means U is C1 in the neighborhood of that, the definition 3.6 is it? Implies the equation. And indeed, you can differentiate the function and test it out. But at points that where it's not C1, maybe other things occur. So let me not talk about any possibility of any non-C1 function, because I mean, and any failure of C1 in any function, because that gets to be too mind-boggling. So what I want to do is talk about, suppose it jumps upon it across a curve. So that's the classic thing. Suppose, so let's examine the solution which is not C1. Oops, it's supposed to be a 1 here. Suppose we examine a solution which is not C1, but in a simple way. So and let's refer to C1. These are going to be classical solutions. Meaning we're not don't have to invent fancy notations or even unfancy notations notions for what it means to solve the PDE. But suppose in to the contrary that that U has a jump, U has a discontinuity. Well, let's simplify the setting, and let's make it let's make U. I don't want to say this. Let's do the following. Here's X, here's T, and let's make it piecewise C1 and just jumping across a curve. So here's some curve, gamma of T, and the gamma of T itself is C1 curve. And let's ask U to be piecewise C1 with possible jump on gamma. And then let's write down the conservation law, which is, well, it's appropriate because I just erased it, so I better remind us what that says. It says that 0 is going to be equal to the time derivative of. And let's do the following thing. I'm going to examine at some time. And I'm going to take an A, B here. So I have to integrate over this interval. Easier to see if I write it in a color. So I have to integrate over this interval. I'm going to check the density and the flux condition over that interval. So the time derivative of the integral from A to B of U dx, leave some space when you write your notes, plus F of UB minus F of UA equals 0. But now I want to differentiate with respect to T inside here. Can I pass the T derivative through the integral? Well, not necessarily if U jumps in that interval. So what you can do is this is the integral from A to gamma T plus the integral from gamma T to B of U dx. I told you leave some space. And that is the same expression. That's conservation law. And it's that that has to vanish for every choice of A and B. So let's see what that that does. So let's carry on calculating. So it's equal to, when I differentiate here, U over this interval is C1 because it's piecewise C1. Okay, so I'm going to get integral from A to gamma of T of d by dt U dx. But the chain rule dictates I get another term from that, which is gamma dot U on the curve. But also, this interval didn't hit the curve. Should have commented to me. I want bigger interval, so I'm actually hitting the curve. Because then I have to integrate up to here, and I have to integrate up to there, and that's a gamma of T. Right? That's a gamma of T, that point. And so the chain rule dictates that it's gamma dot times the value of U at this point. But U jumps. So on the left, it has a value U minus, and on the right, it has a value U plus. And so I'm getting the value U minus, that is the limit from the left of the values of U. And that's this contribution. Plus, this contribution is integral from gamma T up to B of U dx, and the same thing, minus gamma dot, because it's the bottom limit, U plus at gamma of T. I've just done that differentiation. Now I have to do plus, let me see if I do this cleverly, Oh, I guess I'll just do it this way. Plus f at u of b minus f at u of a. That has to hold. That's what conservation means. Thank you. Finally, one more step. Finally, this is an interval over which u is c1. So I have passed this, and I know that the conservation law holds over that. So I can replace this by its fluxes. So that is equal to I can replace this by f at the bottom minus f at the top. So what comes in minus what goes out. So it's f of a minus f of u minus at gamma of t. That's that term. Plus gamma dot of u minus. Then it f of u of a. Yeah. I've switched the two notations. I started out with f of a, but now I have u of a. But you'll live with f of u minus, won't you? Okay. Plus gamma dot u minus, that's that term. And now let me do the same thing here, which is it allows me f at the bottom minus f at the top, right? So that gives me f of u plus minus f of b. And then minus gamma dot u plus. And I have two more terms, f of u of b minus f of u of a. So f of u of b minus f of u of a. Now let's see if I got the signs right. This is plus f of u of b minus f of u of a. And that's all equal to zero. Now let's use blue to cancel. So f of u of a minus f of u of a, f of u of b minus f of u of b. And that leaves me with a relation across the jump, which is, of course, quite simple. It's just calculus with a jump, but we've derived the famous Rankine-Hugoniot conditions, or you might say the jump conditions across a discontinuity. So it says the following. So let me write down 0 is equal to that and include the cancellations. I find the jump conditions. Across a discontinuity or a shock. And those go as follows. Let's see. Let's put the gamma dot things together. U plus minus U minus has got to be equal to F of U plus minus f of u minus. Is that right? Or you might say that the speed that the shock can travel is given by a relation between the values of the limits of u at either side of the shock. It's a simple, but it's a famous thing, right? And so we have shown the following thing, which is not big, but it's still a proposition. So proposition 3.7, which says a piecewise C1 weak solution U of XT, which, let's see what I want it to say, which is discontinuous across the C1 curve, satisfies either one, the equation, so the PDE, So I guess it's just write it. D by dt of u plus d by dx of f of u away from that curve gamma, or to across gamma, it has to satisfy the jump conditions. Gamma dot of t times u minus equals f of u plus minus f of u minus. Okay, speed of continuity. So the speed of the discontinuity, gamma dot, is related to the magnitude of the discontinuity through this jump and the difference in the fluxes. Okay, good. So I want to do another thing, which is I've just been talking about conservation laws. And the conservation law came from a principle of conservation. And then I wrote down something kind of special, like I wrote down Berger's equation. And that was an example, but then anything else which had this funny F floating around. So what equations have I left out? I mean, is that so special that you only see it occasionally? Rhetorical question. What I want to show you is, I want to answer in a short paragraph is, how many conservation laws are there among quasi-linear equations, or among quasi-linear evolution equations? So here's a question. So it's nice because it's so neat, the theory, but how often does it occur? So the question is, how many quasi-linear equations, scalar equations, are conservation laws? Well, what I want to do is, in some sense, just make a normal form for an equation. So let's see. Let me start with an arbitrary quasi-linear equation, d by dt u plus some coefficient c of u d by dx of u equals 0. And let me already immediately cut back my scope. Of course, it should be a times du by dx plus b times du by dy is equal to c. Well, let's get rid of c, and I'll just change the name of the coefficient. And then let's suppose that the y term is non-zero, so I divide by it. So, and that's really what I want to have, is an evolution equation, so the characteristic vector field always has a non-zero component pointing toward the future, well, maybe the past, and multiply by minus one, so toward the future. And so, and then it doesn't depend on x and t or x and y. Well, okay, good enough. Let's just do this. Then I'd like to do the following. Let's suppose that little c of u is the u derivative of a big C of u. How often does that occur? Use a scalar. Integrate little c with respect to u, you get big C. So it always occurs. Okay? And let's examine C1. Suppose we have a C1 solution. Examine u, but let's assume it's in C1. And let's see what happens. And what I want to do is the following thing. So I want to make a transformation. So I want to set u is equal to a nonlinear function of v. I just want to change variables. And then I want, with inverse function, g of v is equal to c inverse of v. I mean, that's not 1 over g, it's the inverse function, right? That g of c of v is equal to v, and v and c of g of u is equal to u, right? C small is invertible. Right. And so now let's just use the chain rule. So I now want to take, what is it? U is equal to G of V, so then the equation is d by dt U. So let's read that equation, and I'll use the chain rule. So I find G prime of V, dt of V, plus C of U is C of G of V, times dx of U, which is G prime of V, dx of V, and that should be equal to zero, because it was for U. And what I want to do is say the following thing. Let's see, where's my hypothesis? Let's make sure that, so we need C of U, little c of U invertible. At least locally near my values of U. So how should we do that? Well, it could be increasing or decreasing. So let's make it increasing, and then decreasing is the other way around. Okay? So let's make it, so let's assume it's an increasing function. So strictly increasing. And then that says that G exists, and if it's strictly increasing, that says G prime of V is not equal to zero. The G prime will never be equal to zero, so then we can cancel this, and we find that partial T, and one more thing, and we're going to find that partial T of V plus something. So then, remember, these are inverse functions, so that G of C of U is equal to U, and C of G of V equals V. So that's d by dt of V plus V, d by dx of V is equal to zero. So we get, that is, come upon, it's a change of variables, it just always gives us Berger's equation. So what does it mean that C is increasing? It means d by du of capital C is, that means that C prime is positive. But that means d by du squared of capital C is positive. So C increasing, C partial u of little c bigger than zero implies partial u squared of big C of u greater than zero, strictly so, the way I've done it, which is convex. So anytime you have a convex function, in this setting, you end up getting a convex flux function. Convex flux function, which is it's not universal, but it's really very common, and it's the good kind of flux functions, and all such revert, at least for smooth solutions, to Berger's equation. So in some sense, Berger's equation is just a canonical form for a quasi-linear scalar equation, at least in two variables. So I had a question for you, which is a problem set question. Did I assign problems last time? So this is problem set 2. So this is number 2. And I have my problem 1, which is, what happens to the jump conditions under this transformation? So under the transformation, what happens to the jump conditions? So under this transformation, a way to say that is, are weak solutions transformed to weak solutions? Are weak solutions transformed to weak solutions? Funny thing is that's the question which says how you interpret it. So what I really want you to say is, how do the jump conditions transform They don't just go to the new jump conditions, they're modified. So really, what the, you know, this is a rhetorical question which asks you to derive how the answer is no for my definition of weak solution. So now give me a new definition of a jump condition in a weak solution, which will survive these transformations. Okay, so that is how do I want to say that. So derive the new jump conditions under this transformation. Okay, I think it's time for our break. Let me tell you where I am and where I wanted to be. Half hour ago, I wanted to be talking about the Riemann problem, but I'm only doing it now. So I'm going to come back and talk about the Riemann problem. And then, seeing how time is going, I guess I wanted to take a little bit of a vote. So yeah, just before the break, I wanted to take a little bit of a vote. Here are the subjects I want to cover. The Riemann problem, fully nonlinear local theory, go back to the F, capital F again, and give a theory and its geometric interpretation. And then I had the thought that I would delve into a global theory of weak solutions for scalar conservation laws. It's a step up, but it's clearly going to take us more than today. So is it worth taking another day to look at conservation laws? It brings us into total variation bounds and interesting constructions of Glim and Lax famous constructions of Glim and Lax in the 70s. I think we can devote an hour to that. I'll try to do that. It seems to be not this week, but I'll try to do that next week. So I'll carry on after our short break with the Riemann problem and then general theory. Oh, and I forgot my vote. My vote, nobody really voted their hands. What I really wanted to vote is, how is the speed of the lecture? Is it way too slow? Just a little bit too slow. Nobody's saying anything. I'll lecture at whatever pace I can until you complain. Let's have a break. start over. Just won't let on to the tape that I actually started talking already. Good. So what is that? Well, actually, that's a very small finite parameter set of data. So that is you specify that u at x 0, that's h of x, because s is equal to x. And how can I make this dilation invariant? Well, all its values to the left of 0 have to be the same, and all its values to the right of 0 have to be the same, but they needn't be the same value. So it has an h minus for x negative, and an h plus for x positive, and I don't know, just assign it arbitrarily equal to it, x positive, to give it a definite value at the origin. And then the Riemann problem of the title is this conservation law with this Riemann data. So this is Riemann data. And so I want to do this for Berger's equation. And I'm going to start by just giving three examples. So let's do three examples. So example one, I'm going to have h minus equals 0 and h plus is equal to 1. What could be simpler? And and of course, Berger's equation is partial t u plus u partial x u equals 0. And then here's my claim that this is a solution. This is a solution. A solution. U of x t is equal to, well, 0 when x is less than 0. So it stays 0 when x is less than 0. It's equal to x over t when 0 is less than x is less than t. And 1 when t is greater than, when x exceeds t. And so let's see, I want to draw a picture of this. Oh, and let's see, we should check that it's a solution. In this region, all derivatives are 0. In this region, all derivatives are 0. And all you have to do is check that a t derivative of this, which is going to be minus x over t squared, is equal to u times an x derivative of this, which is 1 upon t times x over t. So it works. Oh, it's not C1, it's just Lipschitz. You have to check across the two lines where it jumped, where the derivative might jump, that is, x equals 0 and x equals t, that in fact doesn't matter. It's still a weak solution. You can still put the t inside the integral and use the, and you don't have to impose a jump condition. Doesn't jump. Okay, so it's also still a weak solution, which has to check. So let's see. Picture. And what I want to do is a picture. So let's see, I want to do these pictures in these style, that I'm putting the xt plane, and then below it I want to put a picture of the solution, x and z. And let's see if I do this in blue. U initially is 0 here, and u initially is 1 here, and so the characteristics all have zero speed, and they all look like this. Right up to that point, these are the characteristic curves, the x t component of the characteristic curve, the projection of the characteristic curves, And stemming from u equals 1, they all have speed 1. So they look like this. They're supposed to all have the same speed. And between, in this region where x is between 0 and t, there's a fan, which is the level sets of x over t. And now if I'm an observer standing here and waiting as time passes, since u is the density, I see the density constant until here, and then the density slowly decreases as it goes through that region. And so that's the rarefaction of density. So this is a rarefaction wave. So this is a rarefaction wave. And just to draw pictures of it, here's the initial data, 0, and then jumps up to 1. And then at later time, the solution, when x is equal to t, so at time t, at x equals to t, the solution does the following thing. It makes a ramp up, and then it goes over. That's the solution at later time. Okay. Let's do another problem.
In the fan area,
yep.
None of the characteristics really go into that, right?
None of the original.
Does this one come from the characteristics, or at least in that region? Am I right about this?
Yeah, I guess you are. Yeah, it depends on what you think as being the jump. Because, of course, I'm supposed to spawn a characteristic for every x, t, and z on an initial characteristic Cauchy curve. So if I make my Cauchy curve go this way, and this way, every line in that vertical piece can spawn a characteristic too. Just solve x, t, z, but z's are different, and they'll give you those. So, by proper interpretation, yes, it'll work. Okay, so case two. So, example two. Let's let h minus equals 1 and h plus equals 0. Okay, and then we solve the equation. And then u of x, t is equal to 1 for x less than, I'll say, t upon 2, and 0 for x greater than t upon 2. And how did I know t upon 2? So let me draw a picture and show you. So again, this type of picture, here's the x, here's the t, here u is equal to 1, here u is equal to 0. Let me put in the characteristics. These are now moving at velocity 1. And these are moving at velocity 0. So in fact, from time t equals 0, automatically the solution by the method of characteristic has broken down, and we have a multiple-valued solution. Here's x, and here's z. So my data is this again. Whoops, my data is the other one. Sorry. Got ahead of myself, behind myself. Here's the axis. And my data is 1 here and 0 here. And if I extend that data using the method of characteristics, then this data goes over like this, in fact. But what the solution I'm going to draw you says is that, in fact, there's a curve here which is half the slope of this curve. And this is gamma of t. Okay? And on that curve, so that's halfway over here, is here. This is the solution that we want. And let me find you y the half. So what we have to do is we have to check. This is my solution, and we have to check. Well, again, wherever it's constant, all the derivatives vanish, so that satisfies the equation. We have to worry what happens on that curve. So gamma of t is equal to t upon 2, so gamma dot is equal to 1/2. And then I have to do a small side calculation. I've run out of a room there, so I'm going to open up a little window here and do a side calculation, which is I have to check the jump condition across that gamma of t. So what is u plus minus u minus? U plus is, let's see, which order did I write the jump condition? It's no longer on the board. U plus minus u minus is equal to 0 minus 1, so it's equal to minus 1. And then this is Berger's equation, so what's f plus minus f minus? Well, f is half u squared, right? Because u is the u derivative of half u squared. So f plus minus f minus is u plus squared over 2 minus u minus squared over 2, which is equal to u plus, is still 0, so it's minus 1/2, which is equal to 1/2 times u plus minus u minus. So I chose the slope 1/2 to satisfy the jump condition. And I could have, of course, changed the drama of the lecture room by saying what should the curve be, and I would do this jump and find the slope had to be constant because there are constants on either side, and it had to be 1/2 by satisfying the jump condition. So that's, everything is just fine, and we're feeling comfortable. So let me do my example 3. We know about this. Let me do my example 3. So my example 3, which is all the choices of h minus and h plus. So I want h minus is equal to 0, h plus is equal to 1. That is the same as example 1. And then let me draw again a picture. Oh, and then my solution, u x t, is going to be equal to 0 for x less than t upon 2, and 1 for x greater than t upon 2. It's a different solution. So let me draw the picture. Oh, so let me check. So we better check that it's a weak solution, because that's important. So we check the jump condition. Well, it's constant in regions except across the jump, so as usual, it satisfies the equations, but we better check the jump conditions. So I have u plus minus u minus, but u plus is 1, u minus is 0, so this is equal to plus 1. And then f plus minus f minus is equal to u plus squared over 2 minus u minus squared over 2 is equal to 1/2, because u minus is 0, u plus is 1. And so it's, the shock speed is still 1/2. And that's what it is. And gamma of t is equal to t upon 2, so gamma dot is equal to 1/2. Well, it's true. There is a perfectly good solution as far as we've defined to the problem at hand. And it comes out of the same initial data. Very annoying. That means there's let me say it the following way, that we proved shocks form, a smooth solution spontaneously folds over, forms a shock. So therefore, we have to admit solutions with discontinuities and an appropriate sense of what it means to be a solution. So we enlarge our class of solutions. And unfortunately, they're enlarged too far, and there's non-uniqueness. So the idea is you want your class of solutions to be large enough to have all the natural solutions, but small enough to not have so you can still well define what your evolution is going to be. Otherwise, you're in trouble. You can't make choices arbitrarily. So let me draw the picture of this solution, because I've been drawing everyone else's pictures. So that looks as follows. Here's X. Here's T. Here's the H plus is 1, so this is the velocity field 1, with speed 1 throughout here, this region. Right? Velocity field 1 somehow throughout this region. Here's the velocity field 0. And then I'm going to make this pink line, which is the gamma of t, at slope 1/2. So this is this pink line at slope 1/2. It's the gamma of t. Gamma of t is equal to t over 2. And now I was just doing blue a little bit lightly, so I can erase here. And I want to say that here are my characteristic curves now, coming out of the discontinuity. And these blue coming out of discontinuity with the appropriate slope. And we just checked by that little panel that that's a weak solution according to our rules. Okay? So, primary example of non-uniqueness. So, in order to fix the problem, or what can I say? We have to make, at least on this level, we have to make a choice between the solution I gave in 3 and the solution I gave in 1. I mean, we could vote. Who prefers which? So what I want to do is, what traditionally is done, is you make a principle. Well, you should make a principle which chooses, selects one as the good solution, then, and the other one as not a good solution. And so that's called an entropy condition. So that's definition 3.8 of the entropy condition. And let me say it as follows. If U of XT is a weak solution, which is pointwise, C1, and X is equal to gamma of T is a curve of discontinuity of U, that is a shock, we admit U as an entropy solution or entropy condition satisfying solution. We admit U as an entropy condition satisfying solution when, and I have to give you the condition, when the following thing happens. I look at the speed of the discontinuity, and I look at the values of C above the discontinuity, and those should be slower than the speed of the discontinuity, strictly so, and that should be slower than the values of C below the discontinuity. And now with all these pictures on the board, I want to point out when that's satisfied and when that's not. Okay, so example 1, there's no discontinuity. Solution example 2, the speed of the characteristic velocity C is faster below the shock because these are coming in. So that says that C of U minus is bigger than the velocity of gamma, which is, this is velocity 1, velocity gamma is 1/2, and the characteristic velocity above the shock is 0. So it's smaller than gamma dot. So this satisfies the entropy condition. This is okay. Now we go over to the next blackboard. Here, C of U minus is equal to 0, which is less than gamma of T, which is 1/2. And here, C of U plus is equal to 1, which is greater than it. So what happens is the characteristics from which we're defining the solutions aren't going into this continuity, they're coming out of the discontinuity. And that, in some sense, is information that is not dictated by the initial data. So try to say that again. There's one jump condition, but you have two parameters on either side of the shock. So we've dictated what happens on the initial data, but we don't dictate what happens at the shock. We don't give data on the shock. The shock is given to us as a solution procedure. And I can, even with the same shock curve, give new information emanating from the shock and propagating into the solution, which has this value and this value. But of course, there's some freedom, so I can set this value minus this value equal to there's one relation, which is the shock relation. And even if I'm given the shock curve, that fixes the speed. So then I can still adjust U minus and U plus. So I can send out Morse code signals and blips on this side and on this side of the shock with one relation. And I can encode the Encyclopedia Britannica in those blips and send it out of my solution. Or Georges Luis Borges, volume, short story on the library. I could encode that in the shock and send it off, and that will have nothing to do with my initial data. So this is a information generating shock, which is not so physically nice as an information absorbing shock, which is, so that's why this is okay and this is not okay. This is an entropy solution, and that is not an entropy solution. Yeah, because this is the plus side. The plus side should be slower and hit the shock. The plus side should be, the shock should plow into the plus side characteristics, and the minus side characteristics should plow into the shock, and that's the way physics should go. But I also want to emphasize that this is an additional rule, that nowhere in the equation did we see this. We specified it now. And it also is special because we then, once we specify it, the equation beforehand was reversible. And even our sense of weak solution conservation was reversible. But now it's no longer. So we've specified with an entropy condition an arrow of time. So that's a simple but important point. With definition 3.8, accepting this as these are the good solution, we have accepted a forward, a future direction of time. Okay, that's a very important thing to say. Okay, let's see. Good. More problems. More problems. So let me maybe put them down here. So this is problem set 2. And I gave one problem, I only gave one problem so far. So here's the second problem. Give the general solution of the Riemann problem for Berger's equation. I mean, it's pretty simple. It's just patched together like I patched together. I want the one satisfying the entropy condition, that is a 3.8. Satisfying that condition 3.8, that is, I want you to solve d by dt u plus u d by dx of u equals 0, and then I want u 0 of x to be some general h minus and some general h plus. And there should be a difference between h minus less than h plus and h minus greater than h plus. Okay? And then 3. So that's a simple problem. And in fact, I've done it for you. Virtually. So 3, I want to consider not the Riemann problem, but I want to make a different problem, but it also a finite parameter problem. I also want a complete solution. So I want to give the more complicated family of initial data. So a 3, so I want to give the general solution. Of the initial value problem. With 3 parameters. And you can see what's coming. I want the data h of x. This is, of course, u0 is, of course, h of x. H of x is equal to, I want it to be h minus for x less than minus 1. Some middle value, h0, for minus 1 less than or equal to x, less than or equal to 1. And h plus for x exceeding 1. And now that's definitely more interesting. Problem 2 is nice because you get it all settled. Problem 3 is definitely more interesting, in part because problem 2 has only shocks or rarefaction waves, a la our construction before. But problem 3 could have shocks and rarefaction waves coming from each of the points, x equals minus 1 and x equals plus 1, and they can hit each other. And my statement is, you can still solve it exactly and explicitly, and I want to know what happens when they hit each other in particular. That's the most interesting case. Okay? The Riemann problem is the initial dilation invariant initial data. So it means simply the initial value problem with special data, u equals constant on the left, and u equals possibly another constant on the right. So for a given differential equation, in particular conservational. So in fact, I gave 3 solutions to two different Riemann problems, 0, 1, and 1, 0. And now I'm asking for to vary h and see what happens. Okay? And problem 3 is a little more interesting because you'll find problem 2 will be helpful in solving problem 3 up to a fixed time. And after that time, what you just did starts to interact with itself. And that's interesting to see. Okay? And so this solution, what I mean is I want to know the solution. So I should say, solve the general solution addition value, but with 3 parameters, these parameters and these setting, for, I want to make sure that it's clear, for all x over the line and t in the future. And I want to be the entropy, I want to also be satisfying 3.8. Okay. And now, almost, trouble is my, I wanted to be halfway through my lecture at this point, rather than where I am now. But at least I'm going to start. Okay. So what I want to do is change section and talk about general first order theory. Because we did local first-order quasi-linear theory, and then we did more global first-order theory. That is, told you that this is an initial value problem and showed that shocks occur. Now I want to do local first-order fully nonlinear theory, and then we have our good overview of this subtopic. And then if time and endurance permit, we'll talk about the general initial value problem. So let's see. So what I want to talk about, this is actually section 3.4, the first order fully nonlinear equation. So, again, remember we have x in Rn, and therefore u is a scalar, so it's going to be a real number for each x. But, of course, d by dx of u is now a vector in Rn because there are n many x's. And there is a theory which is exactly the same and only slightly more complicated than what I'm going to do, but I'm going to, again, restrict ourselves to having n equals 2, because then I can draw the pictures. And n equals 2, of course, we have x and y. So restrict to x, y in R2. Well, then what do our equations look like? They look like f of x and y and u. It depends on x and y and u, but it could also depend in a nonlinear way on dx of u and dy of u, and what solved this equals 0. So it's not in my notes, but I just thought of a first question. Does every such equation have a solution? Well, just to show that that's just to show you a fast answer, try dx u squared plus partial y u squared plus 1 equals 0. Doesn't have a solution, at least not a real solution. So, answer is no. But you want to get started in cases where you do have solutions. So let's say this. A solution is or will be given by an integral surface. So let's call it S. That's equal to those x, y's, and u of x, y's, such that u as a function of x, y satisfies my equation. To tell you the truth, my equation number in my note, I've been neglecting equation numbers, and my equation number in my notes is 19 by now, so I wouldn't advise writing it down since it has too much discontinuity in it. But it's given by integral surface where u satisfies, so this is in R3, just as before, where u has got to satisfy this equation. And that has a normal. With normal vector, n, well, what is it? It's minus dxu minus partial yu 1. That's what this normal in R3. So, but no longer in the quasi-linear case, it was just a relation saying that there is a characteristic direction field which has to lie in the tangent space to the surface. That's what the equation said. Here, there's a more complicated relationship. So, it's a more complicated relationship with the integral curve, and it's normal. So let me try to say that. So let me just ask, who's seen this theory of characteristics, method of characteristics for first-order fully nonlinear equations? Many people seen that? A few people have seen that. Good. I'm happy. So that means my time is useful to you. So what I want to do is just make a geometrical statement, and that'll be where I'll stop for today, because it's best to have the geometrical picture of the proceedings. So let me say something about this relationship between the surface and its normal. So let's see if I can do this. So let's suppose the integral surface S passes through. Now I'm in trouble with notation. Passes through a point, and I used to call it P naught in the in the quasi-linear case, but I want to reserve that for another one, another quantity. So let's say that point M naught. Okay, and then and that's going to be this X naught, Y naught, and Z naught. Okay, and then. And then of course it's a solution given as it's a surface given as a graph of the solution we want. So that says z naught is equal to u of x naught and y naught. That just says it's a graph. But then the normal at that point is going to be n. Let's see, it's going to be equal to, and I'm going to give it coordinates. It's going to be minus p minus q 1. That's a normal vector to a graph. That's an arbitrary normal vector to a graph of a function u. But of course, being the graph of the function u, it has to coincide with minus dxu at x naught y naught minus partial yu at that point x naught y naught and 1. And so what it means is. And let's say what the tangent plane. Let me also write what the tangent plane. So the tangent plane. What I want just today, all I want to do is draw a picture. And so I'm trying to get all the elements of that picture in place. The tangent plane to S at M naught is, well, it's just given in coordinates. So it's all those X's, Y's, and Z's. Such the following thing happens. Z minus Z naught, because that's Z, X naught, Y naught, Z naught is the base point, is equal to partial X, U, X naught, Y naught, times X minus X naught, plus partial Y, U, at X naught, Y naught, times Y minus Y naught. And so, therefore, what I want to say is, so this equation that I'm trying to solve is a relation that n, which is minus p minus q 1, must satisfy. At that point. Namely, F has X naught and Y naught in it, and the height Z naught, and then I plug in P and Q, and I have to find the zero. So at every point, that defines, well, let's count parameters. At every point, there is two parameters, P and Q, and one relation, F. So in a non-degenerate setting, there's a curve of possible P's and Q's, like a one-parameter family of P's and Q's, which are allowed. Okay? That gives me that curve, those possible allowed P's and Q's, give me a normal. Those are the allowed normals. And each normal gives me a tangent plane. Those are the allowed tangent planes. Let me attempt a picture. And then that's where I'll stop today. So here I have my point M naught. That's X naught, Y naught, Z naught. And let's pretend that this is one of those normals that's allowed. So that's one of the values that were allowed, minus P minus Q, 1. And these are chosen to satisfy this. Well, then that says there's a tangent plane that's allowed this is an allowed tangent plane then for the surface. Okay? But there may be another n allowed. So let's pretend this is another n prime. So that's going to be minus another value of P and another value of Q. And that's also allowed. Well, then there's another tangent plane which is allowed, which might be something like this. See that? So that allows you another tangent plane that the surface can have. And if you then look at the, and then you move P's and Q's around, there should be a one parameter family of them, and those tangent planes have an envelope. And so you can think of it this way, that those tangent planes have an envelope, and they'll kind of, as you move those tangent planes around, at every value of the parameter, there's a line in the tangent plane which skims that envelope. I'll talk about envelopes next time in more detail. And that envelope forms a cone. And that's the famous Monge cone. And so the idea of a solution surface, so a solution surface, the geometric picture of a solution. So a solution surface, I should have said an integral surface, S is chosen such that the tangent space to S at any point M naught contains a generator of the Monge cone at M naught. And the generators I've actually already pictured in here because in order to make it look like a cone, I drew this line. But that's a line in that tangent plane, and here's another line in that tangent plane. And there's the envelope of all those generators. So it's like in three space, every point has a cone. And your solution surface has to pass in such a way that it's that the tangent space of your surface is always contains one generator of that cone. Let's go back to the quasi-periodic case. All those Monge cones collapse to lines. A line is still a one-parameter family. That's the direction field given by the characteristic vector field. And your solution has to be that line always lies in the tangent space. So this is the enlarged version. The cones open up. And still, your tangent space has to lie everywhere in those cones. Starting, I was going to say tomorrow. I don't mean that. Starting next week, I mean, next week's lecture is going to be find some differential equations which describe this construction, where you can describe how to manufacture surfaces in here. And the interesting thing is there's a tie with Hamiltonian mechanics and generating functions, which is nice. So let's stop now.